listeners to Sounding Out's podcast series, an oral chronicle of sound and culture. Sounding Out remixes the everyday with theory, insight, and practice. To learn more, please visit us on the web at www.soundstudiesblog.com. Until then, stay tuned for today's episode.
President Obama says the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers is considering rerouting amid months of resistance from the Standing Rock Sioux tribe and members of more than 200 other Native American nations.
Many returning!
Many returning!
Many returning!
Thousands of individuals from across the U.S. plan to descend upon the nation's capital the day after Donald Trump's inauguration to protest his incendiary remarks about women and minorities.
Now there's protesters. They call themselves the water protectors. A lot of Native American tribes, some environmentalists. And they're saying, hey, don't cross.
Making their point in Washington,
you want to protect the water,
Chicago, Dallas, and in city after city in America and around the world. Today, the day after Donald Trump became their
president.
Welcome
to part two of a special series on Standing Rock, protest, sound, and power. I'm your host, Marcella, and my guest for this podcast is Tracy Rector. Tracy is a Choctaw Seminole filmmaker, curator, community organizer, and executive director and co-founder of Longhouse Media. In the previous podcast for this series, I spoke with Dr. Nancy Marie Mithlow. Nancy is a Native American art historian and associate professor of art history and American Indian Studies. In part one of the series, Nancy experiences the sonic elements of Native activism from many unique ways, one of which is her perspective of listening as a trained anthropologist. But Tracy brings in a different perspective, something that's similar yet unique to her own position of recording sound and visuals to create story as a filmmaker and as a media activist.
So with your work, particularly, you're a filmmaker,
mm-hmm.
and so you record a lot of people and you listen, right? So I would consider you a professional listener just as much as I would consider you
I'd like that.
Right. Like, so that's what Nancy was telling me, that she was she was trained as an anthropologist. So then she was talking about her experience in the Los Angeles recently for the Women's March, and this sort of occurred to her that she was first grew up with an alcoholic, and so from that she found herself always listening as a child.
Mm-hmm.
And then second, she became an adult and became professionally trained as an anthropologist. And then through that, she's realized that she's a professional listener. And so at a protest, she's very engaged in the visuals, and that's what she studies, and that's the information that she writes about and sort of interrogates. But at the same time, she's this professional listener.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm wondering, as a filmmaker, in the recent movements or political movements that have been happening in the United States, but in particular within the Native American or Native Indigenous communities, what you feel like your role has been as somebody who's a producer of media or a producer of sound and visual. Do you feel compelled to disseminate stories, to go out and record?
So it's interesting, and it was fascinating that you brought up about Nancy growing up in an alcoholic home and becoming a listener.
Mm-hmm.
That's very much my reality too, alcoholic abusive home. And so there's this way that I would be in the corner and essentially just blend, not be heard, not be seen. And you become very sensitive to listening to tones and changes in voice and manner just to predict safety. And that skill I've always talked about being incredibly important as a filmmaker, especially a documentary filmmaker, because there's this way where it's important to not obstruct the story and to hopefully have a unbiased opportunity to record what's being shared. And so there's this way where I recognize it's important to be a listener. It's important to, as an artist, visually have that ability to recognize an interesting setting or composition, or even if someone physically would be very interesting on camera.
Mm-hmm.
But there's this other aspect of waiting for the right moments and pausing and listening in a way where I recognize the energy shifting and the person's becoming more open, more emotional, and perhaps more vulnerable. And that's when I recognize that skill from growing up in the way that I did comes in handy, because I'm able to be present. I'm able to recognize an important moment or where someone's emotions are heightened.
Mm-hmm.
And I think those are the most interesting moments on camera, when someone's able to really reach deep within themselves, whether it's funny or sad or anger. But I think a person being able to essentially be amongst family or be themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something I recognize. Something that's been interesting lately. So in Seattle, we're liberal, but there's this, there's a lot of layers to Seattle, as you know, and there's a lot of pushback because our city's becoming incredibly gentrified, like many large metropolitan cities. But there's this pushback because the city, I think, is the third largest metropolitan city that's essentially considered white.
Okay.
And we're getting whiter, Caucasian people.
Mm-hmm.
And the people of color and the artists are being pushed out. So something I'm noticing lately is that people of color, and especially Native people, have been incredibly vocal in terms of showing up and taking up space, but also offering life experience. And that has really shifted a number of movements here. For example, the bank exit movement. It was Matt Remley, who's Lakota, who was the one who absolutely led the city of Seattle in divesting from Wells Fargo. That's $3.3 billion the city has decided to take out of that bank.
Wow.
Yeah, and it's because of Wells Fargo's involvement with the Dakota Access Pipeline. And being able to see Matt leading that charge visually, so here he is speaking from his heart. There's no restrictions. He feels as though he has nothing to lose. He is taking this leadership role, not necessarily out of ego, but just because it's time to stand up and to speak up. And recognizing that opportunity, I think, as you may know, in many Native communities, there's that role of a speaker. And oftentimes that speaker is someone who at times has been a witness or a listener. And so that person brings forward some really important insight and knowledge. And I see that in him. He's very unassuming, yet he's the one who provided the leadership in changing Columbus Day to Indigenous Peoples Day for the city of Seattle, or exiting from Wells Fargo, and other major accomplishments that I believe are empowering other communities in Seattle who are feeling disenfranchised right now.
Yeah.
And another example that I noticed is for the Women's March, Seattle's Women's March happened. There's about 300,000 women that showed up. And as that march was being organized, there is some kind of internal disagreements that I noticed online, and where people were speaking up and voicing, you know, frustration with how it was being organized. And from that space and that moment and that agitation was decided by whatever organizing committees that the Indigenous women should lead the entire march.
Wow.
And there's this awareness from non-Native people that if we're going to really be marching with a, you know, good heart and with purpose, we need to recognize that we're on stolen land. You know, and these things were said, we're on stolen land. There's no justice when you're on stolen land. And Native people deserve, and we owe it to Native people to be up front and to be honored in that way. And so I'm noticing that Indigenous voices are changing non-Natives, you know, people's understanding of just being where they're at and what lands they live on, what people's lands they live on, and just space and being able to be present, but from this Indigenous led energy. And so there's all these women. Here's this young woman, Ayana. She's 16. Mm-hmm. She's Tlingit. She's mixed race, Tlingit, African American, Latina. And oh my God, 16 standing up in front of thousands of people speaking about No Dapple. And that vibration in her voice, not just from being nervous, but being excited and feeling her strength as a woman to speak out. But there, you know what that energy is when you hear when someone's kind of transitioning from being nervous as a speaker to really being excited, and you can tell that they're embracing that moment?
Yeah.
Listening to her, it was like that too. And watching, you know, her mama there and how her mama role modeled for her. And I'm just seeing this playing out again and again in different ways here in Seattle for these important movements that Indigenous people are leading the way and being encouraged to lead the way. And the voices are strong and clear, and the teachings are profound and I think relate to everyone.
Mm-hmm.
And in those instances, I've made the decision to just show up rather than to document.
Right.
And for me, there's something really important in that because, you know, in documenting, there's this barrier too. Having the camera, there's always this tool or this object and a way of perceiving that's very narrow.
Right, because you're looking inside something and listening through something else and not as present maybe as you could be.
Yeah, exactly. And so showing up, there's this way of experiencing the full dynamics of the atmosphere. This moment in time and these acts of resistance and these gatherings or marches, they're activating people to see themselves in a different way or to see their abilities or skills or reminding us that we really don't know how much time we have. So we might as well act now and show up.
Yeah. And I think maybe it's more about the showing up and growing, because as we both know, that Native people have been resisting in this country and gathering and protesting, so to speak, since, well, probably since like
1400 years.
Yeah, to be exact, you know, like 1491, four and a half. You know, so this isn't anything new. But I think in social media becoming a space, and you know, the heightened political world that we're living in currently. Mm-hmm. So all of these things together are kind of this amalgamation of friction that's making this moment, in my opinion, feel very different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, social media has replaced churches and community centers, and that's what they are in a virtual way.
Mm-hmm.
And the space where we share and grieve and offer up joy or lessons. And because there's so many of us, since our population's just, what, three times as much as it was in the 60s during those civil rights movements.
Yeah.
You know, it's our link. It's the way that we can organize and to reflect and to think, because everything's moving much faster. And our ability to respond and heal needs to change. That pacing. And how we started the conversation with Nancy growing up with an alcoholic, or me growing up with alcoholic drug abusers. Mm-hmm. It's for me kind of analogous to what's happening now. I recognize in those moments of pain and fear that I was able to gain some incredible tools as a listener. And I think as Native people or people of color, through all the oppression and through the painful history of this country, we've gathered tools. And right now in this moment, we're sharing them and people are finding strength in those tools.
Yeah. But
they came forward through pain.
And why do you think, and I asked this before to Nancy also, and why do you think now, you know, why now, what happened, or what is the moment that's creating this in Native communities? And again, with knowing that this isn't a new thing, or it didn't just spark out of nowhere, that this has been happening for over 500 years, but this moment that we're in, is there something that, in your opinion or in your experience, that has created this sort of spark?
Well, there's a bunch of teachings about Indigenous people being the source of healing for the planet.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that people take that to heart and are recognizing that we're in turbulent times and unknown times and fairly dangerous and scary times. And for many people who've heard those teachings for a long time, I see individuals and communities stepping up and taking on that responsibility of sharing knowledge and taking leadership and showing up and creating community and talking about food sovereignty and environmental stewardship and protecting our water and bringing forward those deeper lessons that are outside of the self. And relate to all of us being connected. I'm guessing, that's my observation, that people are taking that teaching to heart and are willing to be louder and to be more visible, but also just to be in the space of saying no.
Yeah.
You know, there's been a lot of talk within activists, you know, Indigenous activist communities about decolonizing the mind. And there's been so much training in terms of books and music and gatherings and ceremony about, you know, rejecting old thought patterns and recognizing what re-traumatizes or what re-hurts ourselves and our communities. And I'm trying to think of, well, I just, I feel that elders who've gone through, you know, the termination era and the 70s and various, you know, AIM battles or fish wars, they've been preparing this generation, and people are ready. They're ready to bring that out and work for the greater good. Standing Rock, it was the youth that began that movement. Mm-hmm. And while I was there, the elders reiterated time and again that they are the seventh generation, and that what has been prophecy is manifesting now. And there's this generation of young people who are being told this too.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So it's being reinforced.
Mm-hmm. And it's so empowering too, to be told that you're important and you have this special role and you can do it.
Yep.
When you're attending these marches or gatherings, or when you were at Standing Rock, is there a moment in particular to you that really stood out as a poignant moment audibly, or like the soundscape of it?
Sound, I would have to say, was on Thanksgiving Day.
Mm-hmm.
And we went to the front lines. There was a direct action that was called for. And it was in resistance to the military personnel guarding and protecting and keeping people off Turtle Island. And that's where the burial ground is.
Oh, I remember watching that on Facebook.
And so that, I would say, was visually and audibly incredible, just incredible. People were crying. People were singing. People were asked to be quiet, because there's moments at time where people wanted to get angry and yell, you know, fuck the police. But there were peacekeepers in the crowd that said, it's more powerful to be quiet.
Hmm.
And so that was interesting too, to see how the crowd reacted to that. But it's true. It was supposed to be about faith and prayer. And so they were holding that line very strong. And the media people at Standing Rock asked us specifically, all media people, to not record wild sound.
What does that mean?
So, you know, when you're out in the field and you record wild sound, you're quiet, and it's a way to get just the tone of the area, but also the feel of the environment. You might be able to pick up the wild geese, or you might be able to pick up the wind in the trees.
Mm-hmm.
It would have been instinctual to record wild sound, the activity of the camp, kind of the murmurings, the songs, the people walking around. They didn't want us to do that, one, because there is ceremony happening at different points in camp, but also because that can be used in terms of prosecuting people.
Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm.
In moments, maybe more of marching or sort of political speeches at this moment in time, who do you feel is hearing them? Are the right people hearing them, or are we speaking to ourselves, or are the people who need, are the conversations being had and heard that need to be in order to move forward politically?
Honestly, I don't know. I do feel that people are hearing one another, and some of these imposed divisions are being broken down through actually listening to each other. Just kind of as witnessed through the Women's March and calling for the Indigenous women.
My conversation with Tracy ends with the power and vibration in Indigenous women's voices. As I do the last edits of my recorded conversation for this podcast, I sit on a plane in transit over America, ironically somewhere above the Missouri River, as just announced by the pilot. Thinking about sound, I am aware of the changes and the distracting noise from the airplane as I choose to say this final piece. My current space causes me to reflect on time and movement. 1 year after the United States government's unwillingness to be accountable for the construction of the Dakota Access Pipeline, or DAPL, on the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe's land. This two-part series reflects on that, and on other subsequent events, such as the election of a new administration, increasing threats to Native land, and violence of the police center. Continuing these conversations centered in sound are important because understanding the sonic element of protest helps us to better understand how protest and how politics is heard and felt. In closing, I would like to thank Tracy and Nancy Mithlo for their time and thoughts to create this two-part series with me. In both episodes, we talk about the noises made by the minds, bodies, and songs of those who have taken to public spaces to confront and object to the current political moment. Thanks for listening.